This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ranchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and Yukon Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you as we struggle to get through these winter months here in Connecticut. On today's show, I've really been looking forward to today's show because our guest in the second half of today's show is going to be Dr. Padmanabhan Premkumar. Dr. Premkumar is the president of the Hartford Healthcare Medical Group, a job he just took over. But I really want to talk about telemedicine. It's something you've all heard about. We've talked about it on the show. And there are so many different modalities to it. And how effective is it? You know, we started using it a lot during COVID when people couldn't come to the office and we wanted to still manage their care remotely. So suddenly it thrust everybody into the use of telemedicine. Well, now it's here. And the question is, how effective is it? And we really want to talk to Dr. Premkumar about that and how it's being used by the physicians locally and especially at Hartford Healthcare. So I'm really looking forward to that chat with him to really hopefully get some clarity for all of us on the use of telemedicine. The COVID positivity rate in Connecticut is now 9%. Last week it was 12%. So the numbers are coming down. Influenza is still pretty prominent. And don't forget, the 9% is a conservative number, but it's a number we've been going by here. But what's interesting is that I've been hearing about, and this is purely anecdotal, is that a lot of people have been testing negative at home several times before they test positive. So they come down with an illness, not sure what it is, do the right thing, test themselves negative for COVID, but still have symptoms, and then, you know, a couple of days later, test positive. So I'm not sure if that's really part of this new mutation and how it behaves. One of the things we know about its behavior is that it is very, very highly transmissible, but there are many fewer fatalities. So, you know, I always hear the controversy over, well, they're saying there's so many of these fatalities, but these people were dying anyhow. And that's not the case, okay? That's just not the case. Now, what is true is many of the fatalities have some other underlying condition, like diabetes, obesity, heart disease. But those are not terminal conditions necessarily at that point in time. So you have to understand that getting sick with COVID and stressing your body to try and deal with this infection that's now in your bloodstream has now made everything worse. Now, granted, there are some people who coincidentally have COVID. I'll agree to that. But by and large, when we look at these fatalities, these are people who have conditions that are well managed. And now that management is thrown into chaos. Here's another thing. Here's another hint I think I should share with you. A lot of things have changed when we go to doctors' offices now. And I've noticed that in outpatient offices. So my practices where I work are at Hartford Healthcare in an office in their medical office building and at University of Connecticut in the Musculoskeletal Institute and also our office in stores. In those institutions, in those buildings, you have to wear a mask. But what I've noticed is you will go to other practices and a mask is optional. And it's even optional for the staff. So I stress to you the importance of knowing where you are. So you're in a doctor's office. Who goes to a doctor's office? Probably people who are sick. Now, you might be there for a well visit yourself, but there are people there who are sick. So I prefer that the people I'm around in a doctor's office are wearing a mask. And we shouldn't be shy about asking them to put a mask on. And if they don't, if they refuse, well, you know, that just speaks a lot. Because we know masks work. And you know that you're in an office based on science and good medicine, right? So that's a real issue. But I think we shouldn't be shy about asking people if they're going to provide health care or if I'm going to be in a room with them for a certain period of time, to ask them to put a mask on. I think that that is very reasonable and appropriate. One of the things I wanted to chat about, and I just touched on it last week a little bit, because now we have legalized recreational marijuana. For about 10 years now, we have approved the use of marijuana for pain and medical uses of marijuana. And what's interesting about that is, as we've looked at that, we're trying to figure out, is there any benefit to doing it? So in a recent study, about one-third of chronic pain patients have said they use cannabis to treat their pain. Not purely use cannabis, but in addition to other medications. And this was a survey of about 2,000 people in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And what we've learned is that these people are using it as a supplement. And it may be effective. Some people have said that they've been able to cut back on their use of opiates, or cut back, not eliminate, but their other pain medications. And the problem is, when you talk to pain management specialists, is that may be well and good, but there's so much variability. We don't know how safe or how effective it is. When you think of that many people saying that it's reduced their need for other medications, you say, wow, it must be doing some good. But the fact is that the marijuana plant has been used for thousands of years. So there's nothing new about that. But there are also many thousands of different elements in it, the so-called cannabinoids. So the problem here, then, the struggle is to find out which of the cannabinoids are effective, which are not. And when you smoke one of these things or take one of these gummies or something, you really don't know what you're getting. And there's no consistency between what you're buying. So the point here is that you really need to learn more about the dose and the strain of the cannabinoid if we're going to have any clear knowledge of how effective or safe it is. And it really speaks to us doing more research in this area. And I think that I personally feel that it's somewhat premature for us to be saying that there is good medicine here in using it without that data, and especially that safety data. People are always ready to come down on the Food and Drug Administration. You know, they're releasing things that might not be safe. Well, your state is approving marijuana that may not be safe. So we need to take that all into consideration because these are medications. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back to really talk about an interesting story surrounding this day in medicine. And in the second half of our program, we're going to be chatting with Dr. Prem Kumar about the use of telemedicine and how effective it is and what we can expect in our regular medical care. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right.
We're back on Healthy Rounds. And we're this day in medicine, January 28th, 1949, was when Dr. John Enders reported that he had successfully cultured the polio virus. And he reported that in Science, the journal Science. That was in 1949, and this was a critical step in developing a vaccine for polio. The first vaccine being the Salk vaccine, the injectable vaccine in 1955, and then the Sabin vaccine 2 years later in 1957. And Enders actually went on to later develop the measles vaccine. So he really was a pioneer and somebody on the cutting edge in developing vaccines to keep us safe. But, you know, I was looking into it. I treat quite a few patients in the past, fewer now, thank God, but people who had had polio, and especially what was termed post-polio syndrome of people developing symptoms of polio after having it many years ago. And they thought there was a lot of discussion in the 80s that had these people become reinfected with polio. And what we found through our research and when I was at the University of Michigan and looking at it is that it was really just a function of aging. The polio virus attacks the cells in the spinal cord that go to the muscles, that the motor nerves. So it's a motor neuron disease, like ALS, except it doesn't kill you. And it was self-limited. Once the infection stopped, you had this weakened and atrophied muscle. What's interesting is that they believe that some of the things about polio really go back to ancient Egypt, where they had images of children walking with canes and having withering limbs. The first clinical descriptions were in 1789 by Dr. Underwood in Great Britain, and was formally recognized in 1840 by Dr. Jacob Hein in Germany. But it was really in the late 19th, early 20th century where we would deal with these frequent epidemics. And what it would do is thousands of people would be infected with the virus. And many died because it could affect the motor nerves going to respiratory muscles. So we always saw people with iron lungs to breathe because those muscles could not be innervated and be nourished by the nerves going to them. And many more people, many more than thousands, were crippled by it. But in the 80s, we started to see people come back with new symptoms of polio. And what we found was that what happens is we're all given a certain amount of these nerve cells in the spinal cord. Say, just for argument's sake, 100. Everybody gets 100 of these cells. And when you get polio, it attacks these cells when you're young, so you may only have 50. But 50 was enough to at least function. You may had atrophy of the muscle, but you could still move your leg. But what we also know is as we age, we naturally drop that number down. So what would happen is where you may start with 100 and drop to 75 due to aging, people who only had 50 dropped to 25 and now lost the use of a limb. So it really was not a function of the infection coming back. And that was a big point in terms of treatment and knowledge about polio. So something we like to think about and learn from polio and viruses and especially everything that has gone into saving the lives of so many people with those vaccines. One of the things to talk about, I've talked about this on the show before, the importance of us staying active, right? You've heard the saying, sitting is the new smoking. And a recent article in the Journal of the American College of Sports Medicine really talked about taking a short stroll every half hour, even a 5-minute stroll. So when you're at work and you're sitting for a long period of time, this is not a healthy thing to do. And they found that people who took a 5-minute walk every half hour reduced their blood sugar level by 60%, and their blood pressure also dropped. Now, 5-minute walk every half hour, that's a lot of walking and probably not very efficient, and I'm sure your boss wouldn't like that. But by the same token, 1 minute every hour also reduced blood pressure. So maybe instead of sending someone an email, you go over and have a conversation with them. Another way, in an article just published in the journal Nature, talked about 1 to 2 minute bursts of exercise. Now, I'm not talking about doing a wind sprint, but instead of taking an elevator, maybe it's time to take the stairs. And just that sudden burst of exercise 3 times a day really cut back cardiovascular disease by 50%. Now, I typically use a stand-up desk. I like to stand up. It's actually more comfortable for me in general. But even that, so I always feel like, well, I'm standing at my desk. I have an adjustable desk I could work at, and that's great. I'm doing the right thing. But even that is not that helpful, although it's more helpful for your back, right? When you think about it, sitting puts so much strain on the low back. Your arms are in an unnatural position. Your neck is bent over. It's just not good. So although working in a stand-up position is better, it's also better to move. So even that, it's a good advice to try and move around from place to place rather than just standing in one position. And I've seen more and more people working at this. A lot of offices have now adapted. I even see this at UConn now. Many people have these ergonomic specialists that have come and installed these things to their desk where you have the option of sitting and then you push a button and the computer rises up so you can work standing up. So I want people to keep that in mind. That's something we could do to really promote better health for ourselves and those around us. And it also gets rid of that, you know, that late afternoon fatigue that you start feeling as the day wears on, if you can just do a little bit of walking. Just finding an excuse to be able to walk over to somebody or walk around the office or go to another floor and not necessarily stand there waiting for an elevator and squeezing into that with everyone else. The stairs are, in many cases, very safe, well lit, and a great, great place to get some exercise. So we're going to take a break, and then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Prem Kumar, who's president of Hartford Healthcare Medical Group. And we really want to talk about telemedicine, something we've all become familiar with in some regard, and how we follow up and get our medical care, especially when we're traveling. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Gotcha. When Madame Pompadour was on a ballroom floor, said all the gentlemen, obviously.
Welcome back to Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to have as my guest Dr. Padmanabhan Prem Kumar. Dr. Prem Kumar is the president of Hartford Healthcare Medical Group. He's an internal medicine specialist. And Prem Kumar, hey, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Tony. How are you?
All right, pretty good. Hey, listen, let's start out. Let's talk about the Hartford Healthcare Medical Group. How many people are in the medical group? I know I'm in it, but I never realized how many people are in the medical group itself.
In totality, we have probably more than 1,800 providers across the state, Tony.
Wow. Okay. So what's the new job like?
It's been great. Understanding our footprint and all of the various communities that we serve, we provide a complete total continuum of care, and learning all of the various folks that serve all of our patients has been a wonderful experience. Visiting our practices, meeting our patients, it's been a great experience in the first month.
Wow, that's great to hear. But let's get to, I really wanted to get on this topic of telemedicine for a while. Because it's so vast. Can you talk to our listeners a little bit about some of the history behind telemedicine?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think first from a definition perspective, simplistically, if you look at the World Health Organization, you know, telehealth is probably defined as just health from a distance, simplistically, right? So if you expand that, it's sort of remote healthcare and consultation to patients where the providers and patients probably aren't there together at the same place at the same time. This day and age, you know, if you start from house calls to now urgent care clinics, I think on-demand healthcare is becoming the hot commodity. I think the modern patient looking for 24/7 access to their providers. But the advent of telemedicine, I think, is much longer than what people actually think. I think it actually started first half of the 20th century. I think if you look in the 1940s in Pennsylvania, I think radiologists were exchanging images 20-plus miles across multiple townships. That's expanded. I think if you go into the 1950s and 60s, I think University of Nebraska, probably trendsetters, set up two-way televisions, exchanged medical information to medical students across their campuses. And then it expanded outside of healthcare, I would say, went into NASA, Department of Defense, home health services into the 60s and 70s. And then now I think you're seeing the extent of telemedicine beyond urban locations. We're going into rural areas, long-term care facilities where there's a lack of access to healthcare in those locations. And that's sort of, I think, where telemedicine has landed now in 2023.
You know, it's really amazing because I guess I was practicing telemedicine 35 years ago because you'd take a phone call, right? I mean,
right.
People would call you all the time. You didn't necessarily bill for it, but you put a note in the chart that you had this conversation and you changed this, that, and the other thing. But, you know, it's recently become not only more popular since COVID, but it's really come into the press because we have so much new technology, right? And sure. What technology can be used or can't be used. Can you talk a little bit about the technology behind? I mean, everybody has FaceTime these days, right? But that's not necessarily an acceptable way of doing it from what I understand.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I think if you touch on the various types of telehealth, I think the first is live video, and I'll touch on live video to answer your question. The second major mechanism is store and forward, where recorded video or images can be submitted. And then the third is, I think, sort of this remote patient monitoring, which is the next foray into digital technology, which is basically the ability to sit in a patient's home, for example, obtain vital signs, blood pressure, blood sugars, and transmit it to the providers. And then the last is, I think, simplistically audio visits. It's essentially two-way communication using a telephone, for example. This day and age, from a video perspective, I think it's beyond FaceTime or any Google device that you may use. It's connecting to an electronic medical record because there has to be some protection from a health information perspective. And so that's why whether you use any EMR, whether each healthcare system has, such as Epic or anything else, that's sort of the best way to perform telehealth this day and age.
So let's talk a little bit about the devices, because I find that fascinating. So I think what you're saying is, so you could do a telehealth visit with the patient and have monitoring devices already in the home to give you, like, live information?
That's correct. Go ahead, please.
No, is that kind of like, you know, we see all these ads for things with the iPhone, right? So yep. People put their fingers on a new pad, the cardia thing, and they could transmit their heart rate. So we're talking about things like that?
That's exactly correct. You can have pulse oximeters that are connected via an iPad or an iPhone that transmit information. Similarly, blood pressure, similarly blood sugars that you take with your devices at home that can transmit information either through a wire or via Bluetooth directly to those devices that can be sent to your provider. So that's the new age. You know, there's care respiratory, you know, our COPD patients, you have continuous monitoring for pulse oximetry at home, exercise monitoring that they can do. So many advents in many different specialties this day and age.
Let's talk a little bit about the restrictions, because that's one of the things. I've been doing telehealth for a very long time because many of my patients are athletes who travel a great deal and other performers. So if they need to be seen, it's not convenient for them to necessarily get on a plane. They'll usually fly in here, see me in the office, either at Hartford Healthcare or UConn, and then they go about their job, which is traveling. So a lot of times our follow-ups are done via telemedicine. And I'm told that, so what are the restrictions to doing that? Because I know that when you do this as an initial visit, you need to be licensed in the state you do it in. But I'm told that if you establish care and then do it as a follow-up, as in my case, that you don't have to be licensed in whatever state they're in, because it could be any other state or country in many cases. How does that work? How do these restrictions work?
Yeah, so I think you're sort of talking about billing and reimbursement restrictions. So if you talk about billing and reimbursement requirements for telehealth, it actually varies depending on payers, insurers, and different geographic locations. You know, the fundamental concept, I think, Tony, is you should be licensed or legally permitted to practice in the states where you or your patient are physically located. However, there are some nuances to that statement. Maybe it might be easier for our listeners if we go through specific scenarios. You are right in that
Please.
You have an established patient you had an initial in-person visit. There are definitely current rules and regulations that allow you to permit telehealth. So, for example, if your patient was in the state of Connecticut, established patient with you, but travels, let's say, temporarily to another state, the question is, are you able to perform telehealth? The answer is yes. Now,
let's say Florida. A lot of our patients go to Florida, right? They're winter, right? Yeah. They're in Florida now.
Yeah, and Florida, for example, has some laws after COVID where it temporarily allows providers to perform telehealth who are licensed in other states, and you don't have to be licensed in Florida, for example. So there, you're allowed to perform that. The other scenarios could be, well, what if your patient permanently moves out of state, but it's established with you? Could you do telehealth? That becomes a little bit more difficult because my first statement falls into play, which is, are you licensed and legally permitted to provide care for you and your patient where they're geographically located? We may actually say it's better for the patient to seek a care provider that's located in the state. The third example you could think of is, what if you, as a provider, move to a different state and temporarily? There again, licensing requirements come into play. State requirements in terms of where is your patient located, those are the nuances that happen. But in general, I think the rules and regulations are a little bit lax now, but they're still state to state, but many states are rolling back. But I think you're still allowed and permitted to perform telehealth for an established patient, at least in the state of Connecticut, who travel elsewhere.
Okay, that clarifies a lot of things for me, and I think for a lot of providers who are involved, because we never, it's hard to get a straight answer on this. I'm finally getting some clarity here, so I really appreciate it, because, you know, one of the other things we think about is reimbursement.
Yeah.
Specifically in my case, I'm typically reimbursed by the organization. So the organization will, for whatever it is, will pay Hartford HealthCare for my services, and I don't get paid for a specific visit. My job is to keep those athletes healthy. But in the case where someone is doing a service and billing a code, what are those kinds of restrictions now?
Yeah, so great question, Tony. I think start with the telehealth legislation in Connecticut, right? So the state of Connecticut passed their legislation called an Act Concerning Telehealth, which is Public Act 21-9, on May the 10th, 2021, and that actually extends to June the 30th, 2023, which is later this year. So we will see what telehealth local legislation looks like past June. But the act actually allows for a lot of flexibility for telehealth offerings, and it actually requires insurance coverages to cover these services. And under these legislation, the insurance companies must provide appropriate reimbursement for telehealth visits comparable to in-person visits. But if you look at an organization such as ours and said, well, Dr. Prem Kumar, how does that apply to these insurance companies and how they partner with large organizations, a lot of it is determined by rates that are determined by national policy and what your contracted rates are for a face-to-face visit. That's how the reimbursement occurs. But in general, based on the rules and regulation in Connecticut, appropriate reimbursement comparable to in-person visits for these telehealth visits is what I would say.
So taking that a step further, and when we talk about how effective is telemedicine? You know, they're trying to do studies and figure this out. And I think they have a lot of obstacles because there are so many, as you've pointed out quite well, there are so many different ways of doing telemedicine. And often telemedicine is mixed with in-person visits. For example, if I have a patient who is stable on multiple sclerosis, I need to see them every 6 months to renew medication for their multiple sclerosis. That's an insurance requirement. I will typically see them in person once a year, and that six-month visit is done by telemedicine. To me, that's very effective medicine. And I think for especially a patient who is working, okay, and very active. But let's look at the flip side of it. We have many patients who can't, specifically in the area of movement disorders, Parkinsonian patients, and people where it's a real struggle to get out of the house, arrange transportation and things like that. So in my narrow world, I see it as being effective. How do you see it, and how do insurers see it globally? Is this an effective way of administering healthcare?
That's a tough question and a good question, Tony. I think we are evolving, I think from a legislation perspective, to truly determine efficacy since 2020 to where we are today. I think that providers and patients are showing that there is definitely benefit to telemedicine in a multitude of different arenas. So if you look at where it started to where we are today, the current places where telemedicine is being used, so if you look at urgent care, sick visits, you know, respiratory illnesses, minor issues such as, bronchitis, upper respiratory infections. If you look at post-acute care, which is patients who are transitioned out of the hospital to home, and you're using remote patient monitoring to check on their vitals, to make sure they're doing well 7 to 10 days after they've been transitioned out of the hospital setting. Hospice care, for example, patients who are being managed remotely. It's showing you that there is definite value. I think from a payer perspective, their lens may be a little bit different in terms of what settings to use it in and what settings not to use it in. But that's, I think, where as you look at the public health emergency, which sort of runs out maybe December 2024, and CMS and federal regulations are going to now look to where we are going to go, they're going to look at the context of where we are giving care, how are patients being managed, and where we will go in the future. I will tell you that in an elderly aging population where chronic disease management is going to be the burden from a healthcare system perspective, I don't think we can get away from not providing telehealth. So I think the future is a combination of legislation and payer and provider all working together in one form or fashion to deliver telehealth, and there has to be reimbursement that sort of fits within that methodology. I hope I made sense there.
Yeah, you did, very, very clearly. But let's flip things a little bit, because we've talked about the patient side of telemedicine. But, I first started becoming familiar with telemedicine when we had stroke codes, right? When, we finally had TPA, and a neurologist had to examine the patient to see if TPA was appropriate, or now even clot retrieval. And these decisions have to be made within minutes. So suddenly, we were using telemedicine. There were telemedicine companies cropping up all over the place, but we used it effectively at Hartford and still use it and in other places. I don't see that going away, because that's a life-saving decision that has to be made within minutes, and certainly not enough time to get a physician to the hospital. How do you see that? Is that pretty much safe for the future?
More to come there, Tony. I think that telehealth, at least in the outpatient setting, has definitely shown benefit, and there's rules and guidelines that are built in. On the inpatient and the acute care side, whether it's hospital to hospital or whether it's location-based, meaning Dr. Alessi is located in Hartford, but there's a rural location in Connecticut where his services may be desired, I think there's benefit there. I would say that that currently it's safe. I would say, again, the future, I think, is 2024 and beyond. I think that that likely rules and regulations may allow us to evolve to a better place in an acute care setting. I just don't see how I think community hospitals, large tertiary care centers, now how care is being provided, time is of the essence, whether it's cardiac or neurology or other services, where I really think that in the future is telemedicine in those locations. To make life-changing decisions such as medications or getting a helicopter to transfer a patient for a potential emergent surgeries, I just don't see how that goes away. I do think that legislation and regulations there are going to loosen over the next couple of years. And currently with COVID and PHE, public health emergency, which is allowing some of these waivers to kick in, I think it's going to become standard of care a year or two from now.
Looking at it from a physician's standpoint, I have a good friend. I'm going to give you an example. A good friend who years ago, she had a wonderful neurology practice, but she was a solo practice, which was hard to do, right? All these requirements, electronic health record, staff requirements, things like that. So she decided to get rid of everything, sold her building, sold the practice, and went to work for Physicians on Call, POC. A well-known company nationally. She's a neurologist and would do, stroke emergencies and inpatient all from her home through telemedicine. And has said that she'd never been happy. She has never been happy. She's been doing it for years now. Do you see young physicians just going straight into that? In other words, after they've finished their training, whether it be in specialty training or in internal medicine, just saying, listen, I really don't want to have an office. I want, I have a young family or whatever. Do you see physicians opting for a telemedicine career?
Two separate parts to your question. I think the first part to your question is I'm sort of old school in my thinking. I think that providers who evolve to do telemedicine should at least have a good bit of experience with in-person and managing disease and conditions, seeing patients face-to-face. I think, as you know, Tony, you cue into a good bit of history that people tell you, and you cue into what a diagnosis and treatment based on what you've seen, your experiences, and what you have read. And if you don't have that, it makes it very difficult for you to connect with your patient in that setting. With that being said, your second part is you're talking about young providers potentially transitioning away from in-person to telehealth. We are seeing a shift there. But again, I would advocate to say at least a balance between in-person to telehealth, because that way then you're approaching patient care in that fashion and giving the patients truly what they deserve and trying to get them to where care needs to be, the right place at the right time, which is one of the restrictions for telemedicine, right? So if you look at the restrictions, you need to truly, as a provider, need to know what is their past medical history, what are the chief complaints, and then what is the standard of care in that setting? If the standard of care is an in-person visit, telehealth for that specific patient probably doesn't make sense unless there's no other recourse. So that's why, absolutely, I think we're seeing a shift, but I think it's a right provider, right time, right context is what I'd say.
Well, Prem Kumar, you hit the nail on the head, because even in the case of my friend who used it as an example, she has opted to start to do locums as she did it. So she would go do telemedicine, but she would spend a week, a month actually seeing patients in different areas. And it's probably why when she presented me with the opportunity, I didn't take it because I do enjoy being in the room with the patients and their families. I want to thank you. Thank you for spending time with us today. And really thank you for taking a leadership role. It's not an easy job, that's for sure. Leading 1,800 physicians and other providers. So I want to thank you. Thank you for taking a leadership role, and thank you for everything you do for the patients in our community.
Tony, we are here for our patients and our communities. Happy to serve. I think this is what we all signed up for, right? So thank you for the time this morning, and if you ever need me back, I'm happy to join.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Take care.
That was Dr. Padmanabhan Prem Kumar, the president of the Hartford Healthcare Medical Group. So many thanks to him and the folks that really made the connection for me to get him on the air. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board for me today. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week on Healthy Rounds, we're going to be discussing eye care again, but we're going to have Dr. Mary Gina Ratchford on. She has been a big supporter of our program, but always brings with her some new information, and there's a lot going on. So she's going to spend some time with us next Saturday. If you have questions in advance for Dr. Ratchford. You can get them to me at info@alessimd.com. Or if you have any questions regarding today's program. If you missed part of today's program, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast and download it on Odyssey.com or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.